So we are discussing tonight apple and honey and much more. Basically, if we could talk about anything positive in terms of the last few months that we've gone through, I think one thing that is has a part of a positive element is that we've shifted focus to the home, where it's really supposed to be. You know, we got so used to shipping kids off to school, going to synagogue if we want to do something spiritual. And certainly in terms of spirituality in Jewish tradition, the notion that the synagogue is the center of Jewish religious life is very, very un-Jewish. In Jewish tradition, it's the home that's the center of Jewish life. And synagogue is important and it has its value, but Judaism is meant to be lived in the home. So what we're going to do tonight is discuss ways that we can make our Rosh Hashanah festive holiday meal meaningful and infused with spirituality and meaning. You know, someone sent me a list of cute things. Sometimes when a teacher asks a question to the kids, the kid comes from left field with something cute or funny or profound, you know, and so some of them were really very funny. So one of them was that this teacher in Sunday school, Hebrew school, said to little Joey, tell me the truth. Do you pray before you eat? And Joey said, I don't need to pray before I eat. My mom is a good cook. So, but we do pray before, even whether our mom is a good cook or not, usually they are. We pray before we eat. Every time we eat something, we say a prayer, a bracha, a blessing traditionally. And on Rosh Hashanah, we say even more specifically certain prayers that we are basically asking God in different forms for positive things in the new year. You know, we're told that in Jewish tradition that an omen, doing something like this, a ritual or connecting our prayer to a sweet fruit has a spiritual power. And also these tools can be viewed as spiritual visual aids. It's a very contemporary notion that we want to say a prayer, we take a fruit or something to focus on, and that's a visual aid to help us focus on the prayer that we're saying. So there are different fruits that we eat, and basically either they're sweet, so we eat them and ask for a sweet year, or the name of the particular fruit in Hebrew or in Aramaic, which was the language of the Talmud, somehow is connected to blessing or sweetness or many, or lots, and so we say these different little prayers. Now, with before we get to the more symbolic foods, we know that in Rosh Hashanah, as we mentioned, we have the apple and honey, and also when we eat challah, the special bread that we eat on Shabbat and holidays, we dip the challah in honey instead of salt, and then we have an apple in honey. On the most basic level, these are two things that we put honey on them because honey is sweet and we ask for a sweet year. But there's also different messages that our tradition tells us about these two symbolic foods that with which we mix honey. Now, challah and honey, this is something that, you know, sometimes if you ever meet people who are like very, Jewish people that are very educated, you know, PhDs in Judaism, sometimes it's cute to test them because this is something that many people are not aware of, not that they're well known. In the Torah, we have something that's described as a piece of dough with honey. Try it on some of your very learned friends. It's not so obvious, but what it is the manna. You know, when the Jews were in the desert for 40 years, so Jews, of course, want to know what's to eat. Jews want food. So we had special spiritual food falling from heaven that's called manna, right? And the Torah describes the manna as a piece of dough fried in honey. That's what it tasted like, piece of dough in honey. So on Rosh Hashanah, we take our challah and we dip it in honey so that it should be similar and remind us of the manna that we ate in the desert for 40 years. Why? They seem to be disconnected. The man in 40 years was miraculous bread falling from heaven. The challah that we eat is just plain ordinary bread. What's the message? The message is, our bread is not ordinary bread. Our bread is as much a miracle as the manna was. We don't get excited about it. We don't say, wow, because we got used to it. We don't have time now because in the Zoom is, they have to be short, but if you go through the history of wheat and how it's planted and how it grows and flour and the whole process that ends up in a delicious piece of bread or challah, we would say wow all the time if we weren't used to it. So in Rosh Hashanah, we remind ourselves that our bread, our challah, is a miracle just like the manna is. Right? Then we have the apple and honey. Again, the most basic level, it's something sweet. We ask for a sweet year, right? I want to share something that I always think about on Rosh Hashanah in terms of the apple and honey, which I think is something that is worth thinking about. That's why you think about it. You know, there are two ways that we can look at the world. We can look at the world like a scientist or like a poet. A scientist wants to take a leaf under the microscope and examine it, all the details. The poet looks at the broad picture, the forest and the beauty, etc. And we have to do both. Really, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are different. On Rosh Hashanah, we don't discuss our sins. We don't say confessionals like we do on Yom Kippur, right? Rosh Hashanah, we don't talk about sins. Rosh Hashanah, we're poets. We look at the big picture, how God created the world, and we remind ourselves that there's a purpose to the world, that God created the world, there's meaning to our lives, etc. And Yom Kippur was a scientist. Yom Kippur, we examine our lives in detail, right? If we take a poet's look at apple and honey, we'll find something very, I think, very fascinating. You know, I always think to myself, picture a summer day, you have people outside in the backyard, on their deck in the backyard, right? And they're relaxing and they have some fruit platters out there. May have apples, mango, kiwi, peaches, nectarines, strawberries, apricots, raspberries, all types of fruit. And they're relaxing and they're noshing on the fruit. And there's a bee flying around. We get frustrated and we say, oh, get away. What a nuisance, this bee, get away. There's something ironic about that scenario. Sitting, eating all these delicious fruit, and a bee, we shoo away because the bee is a nuisance. Anyone know where I'm heading? There's a connection between the bee and the fruit that I listed. All the fruit that I listed would not exist if it wouldn't be for the bees. They're all a result of the pollination of the bees. So sometimes we shoo away the bee, not realizing, you know, if the bee could talk, the bee would say, "Big knocker, you're shooing me away. Without me, you wouldn't have the fruit." And if we just reflect a little bit on the history of of honey and an apple, it's amazing. You know, how does it start? We have a bee flying around. And then, there's a colorful flower over there. Curious. Goes over to the, he's attracted by the bright colors, goes over to the flower, bends down and says, there's some nectar here. That looks delicious. And so the bee takes a little bit of nectar on its tongue. Right? Now this nectar, which eventually is going to be honey, this nectar is a liquid. Honey has to be solid, more solid, right? No problem. The bee has an enzyme that it injects into the nectar and makes it solidify. The bee goes back to the hive with this nectar that it collected. That's been solidified somewhat by the enzyme. But there's still some liquid. What happens? No problem. The bees start flapping the wings in incredibly fast, quickly, and by doing that, they evaporate whatever liquid is left in the nectar, and da 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 da, you have honey. Any time that we should say wow about that, you can tell kids about this process. And you can Google any place, and because it's always discussed, the amazing work of bees. And you can say bees are amazing creatures, or we can say, look at God's world. Look at this amazing thing. Look at how this bee is endowed with all that it needs to take the nectar and make it into honey. Now, after the bees, by the way, after all the bees back in the hive flap the wings to evaporate the liquid in the nectar, they start dancing. And that, and we know today, the scientists know that the dance is communicating to the other bees, hey, there's some great nectar over there. You know, our little friend, the bee, just came back with nectar, and it dances and points in the direction of the nectar so the other bees can go and find it. Okay, that's honey. What about the apple, right? So meanwhile, back at the ranch, when the bee bends down to take some of the nectar, it happens to have some pollen on it that it got from a different flower. In fact, we know that bees are endowed with baskets that hold pollen. They even have little brushes. It's amazing. They have little brushes on their body that brushes the pollen into these baskets. Then when the bee bends down to take some of the nectar, by accident, some pollen falls onto the flower, pollinates the flower. And that's how you get fruit like apples and plums and peaches and nectarines, etc. So this, the process that happens for us to have the honey and the apple, it's just an amazing process. You see the interaction, and actually we see this in Jewish tradition as a symphony. All the different elements of the world, of the universe, that interact like this, like the bees here producing the apples and honey, is one big symphony. The world is a big symphony, right? And every member of the symphony is programmed to do what they do, right? A bee does what it does, a dog does what it does, a cat does what it does, a plant does what it does. They're all programmed, and they create this tremendous symphony. What is the role of human beings in this symphony? So it depends. There are actually two options. We can be the conductor of the symphony, because every other member of the symphony is programmed. We're the only ones that have the free will, and we have to choose to do the right thing. So we are the conductors of the symphony. We lead the symphony. Or if we opt out, we can be the only creature in the entire universe playing off key. Because the bee does it perfectly. The cat does it perfectly. We have the ability to focus and be the conductors, or we can have the dubious distinction of being the only creature that in the symphony that's playing off key and ruining the symphony. This is just such an opportunity to remind ourselves on Rosh Hashanah and to share with our children and grandchildren this amazing symphony in the world and our place in it. You know, I always say that there are five words that we must tell our children and our grandchildren, or even anyone that we're close to, right? So most people, when I say five words you must tell your children, most of you are thinking probably, I love you so much. That's five words. And it is important to say those five words to our children, right? But at least as important, and probably more important, I think, the five words you need to say to our children is, you are not accidents. You're not here by accident. You didn't just, like, some accident, some fluke, 5-6 billion people, whatever it is, are in this world, and you're one of them. No, you are here because God put you here, because he needs you to be part of his symphony. He needs you to make this world the kind of world he wants it to be. Right? So Rosh Hashanah is the time, and as I always say, that self-esteem is a huge problem in our society. And it's this perspective that gives young people and adults and grandparents a sense that they're important, because they're part of the symphony. In fact, they're called upon to be the conductor of the symphony. So we have an apple and honey. Yes, we say the prayer that we should have a sweet year, and remind ourselves, wow, look at this amazing world that God created. It's part of the poetry, being a poet on Rosh Hashanah, and to realize our place in this symphony. So that's an apple and honey. Still here? Awake? Yep. Okay. Now, I don't know if you folks have the sheet in front of you, but the next one I want to focus on is carrots. We eat carrots. Now, some of you may be familiar with the traditional dish called tzimis. Tzimis is carrots and honey, or and whatever else, raisins, other things in it. And we eat carrots in some form, and we say a prayer, may it be your will, our God, and God of our forefathers, that our merits increase. The reason for this is that the word carrot in Yiddish is merin. Merin is like more. So we take the carrot, we say that we want more merits. Our merits should be increased. Our good deeds should be increased. Okay. Sounds good, right? Think about being Jewish. We don't, yeah, okay, sounds great prayer. Go for it, you know. We do. We go for it and we recognize that our tradition gave us these prayers. At the same time, as Jews, we say, one second. Has to make sense, right? Here we're taking a carrot to remind ourselves, a visual aid to request of God that we should have, our merits should be increased. We should do a lot of mitzvahs, a lot of good deeds. We should have a lot of merits, right? Now, if I were God, how's that for a bizarre statement? If I was God, and people prayed to me and said, God, I want to do a lot of mitzvahs this year. I want to have a lot of merits this year. I would say, okay, fine. You know what? Do it. If you do them, you'll have them. God doesn't force us to do good deeds. It's totally up to us whether we do good deeds or not, whether we do a mitzvah or not. Do we smile at somebody? Do we give charity? Do we give some time to a person who needs our time? All these are things that we have to decide to do. God has told us through the Torah that he wants us to do them. He doesn't force us. We have to choose to do them. So what does it mean when we say to God, our merits should increase? It doesn't seem to be something that we can request of God. You know, I may have once told the story that this fellow came to this big mystic, a Kabbalist, and he said to the mystic, I want to do tshuva, I want to repent. I want to become closer to God, right? So the mystic closes his eye in deep concentration. For a few seconds, and he says, okay, I spoke to God, the creator of the universe. I told him that you want to become better and closer to him. His answer was, it's okay with him. Do it. You have to do it. God doesn't do it. God doesn't bring you closer. You have to do it. So when you say to God, I want to have many merits, what does that mean? So one of the things we're told is that it's true that anytime we have the opportunity to do a good deed, a mitzvah, right, we have to decide to do it. It's up to us to do it. We can't ask God to see to it that we do it. But whether we have one thing that is not always in our hands and is in the hands of God is the opportunity coming our way. In other words, sometimes an opportunity comes our way. And someone who's in need of our time or a smile or our financial assistance comes our way, and we have the opportunity to choose to do it. Right? So when we ask God that our merits should increase, what we're saying is, please give us the opportunities. We have to be proactive. You know, the Jewish idea of chesed, of kindness, it's not sufficient to be reactive. If I see someone in need, I will respond. You have to be proactive. Means we have to look for opportunities to be able to help other people. And by the way, when we do that, we're actually being godly. Every time we do an act of kindness, we're being godly. When we are proactive, we're being even more godly, because when God created the world, it was a proactive decision on his part to create the world so that he can give us pleasure. He can do kindness to us. So being proactive, God created the world through being proactive in kindness. And every time we try to be proactive by asking for the opportunities, then we're being even more godly. Okay, that's carrots. Now I'm going to go on to beets. By the way, these symbolic foods are generally very healthy and the low fat, the vegetables, the beets are extremely healthy. And when we eat the beets, we say, may it be your will that our adversaries be removed. So simply understood, this is a reference to our enemies. So, you know, this rarely ever been a time in Jewish tradition, in Jewish history, that we didn't have enemies out to destroy us. So we pray that our enemies should be removed, right? And that's certainly true, right? Again, our tradition tells us that when we say our adversaries, our enemies, it doesn't only mean people who threaten us physically. It means anything that's a threat to the quality of our life, and certainly to the spiritual quality of our life. So why does that include? You know, part of being Jewish is that we have to be very aware of things that can pull us in the opposite of direction of the way we should be heading, spiritually, in terms of our relationships. So I don't know if this will come like a shock to any of you, but it would seem that when we talk about our adversaries being silenced, one of the things that we might be referring to, our smartphones. Our smartphones could be adversaries. You know, you don't need a rabbi to tell you that and this is many, many experts have pointed this out, that we suffer tremendously as a society by the fact that we're always on our smartphones, and our relationships suffer, and the quality of our life suffers. Right. So when we say that our adversaries should be silenced, right, we should include in that things like our smartphone. Now, Jewish tradition doesn't tell us to be like Amish, you know, don't use a phone, but it does tell us to be careful that the phone that's meant to enhance our life doesn't overtake our lives, right, and really do tremendous damage to the quality of our lives and to our relationships. Now, the Torah gave us a gift to help us in this battle of preserving our life despite the onslaught of our smartphones. What is that gift? Shabbat. Shabbat is the one day that our tradition tells us, you know what, shut it off completely. You know, and I think on Rosh Hashanah, when we're looking as individually, as a family, for what we would call a resolution, something that meaningful that we can do, I say this is an excellent thing to think about, right? Our smartphones, and take advantage of Shabbat, which is the gift, to silence our smartphones. Now we might say, but I don't observe Shabbat. You know, obviously I advocate observance of Shabbat. It's a very precious gift, but we can incorporate into our Shabbat that either shut it off in the entire Shabbat or part of the Shabbat or during our Shabbat dinner to shut it off. And then we're doing something meaningful and connecting it to Shabbat and removing something that's really, really a threat to our well-being. You know, I saw somebody who brought this point out very powerfully. It was a graphics designed, again, to get people to think about what our smartphones are doing to us. Right, and what the graphic presented was, it was a fenced-in area with a bunch of smartphones standing vertically, like this. And on the smartphones was inscribed, "Here lies my precious relationship with so and so." That was very powerful. I don't know that I would necessarily do it, but it got the point across that we have to realize that relationships suffer because of the smartphones, right? So Jewish, again, our tradition tells us we have to realize that there are things other than enemies, physical enemies, that can really, really, really challenge the quality of our lives. Okay, I'm going to go out to pomegranates. You're from Brooklyn, Adrian. What did they call pomegranates in Brooklyn? You have Chinese apples? Anyone ever hear the word Chinese apples? I grew up, a pomegranate was a Chinese apple. I don't know where pomegranate came from, but we always call it a Chinese apple when I was growing up. Anyways, a pomegranate has a lot of seeds, right? You know, there's a Jewish, I would say Jewish tradition, but there's like a sort of Jewish folk tradition that anyone heard this, that a pomegranate has 613 seeds. What's 613? That's the number of mitzvos, of commandments in the Torah, right? So the seeds, 613 seeds, and that corresponds to the commandments in the Torah. Now, growing up as a kid, 78 years old, I think it happened to many kids. I said to myself one time, I'm going to count this once and for all. So 8-year-old kid sits down and opens the pomegranate, starts counting. They get to 75 and they fall asleep, but they stop soon. So no one really ever counted it, right? And I don't think it's literally true, but there's such a tradition that the many seeds represent the many, many commandments. We eat a pomegranate, again, we say that our merits should increase as the seeds of a pomegranate. Same thing as before, we should have many merits, so many merits like the seeds of a pomegranate, right? Again, the question is, what do you mean our merits should increase? Again, merits are something that we have to do, right? So there's another insight into this similar request when it comes to the pomegranate. When we say our merits should increase, right? There's a statement in the Talmud, which is a very, very important statement. Talmud says that even sometimes we meet somebody and we think that there's nothing good there. We don't see anything good, right? And the Talmud says you should know that even the person who looks like they're free of good deeds, of merits, they're really filled with good deeds like the seeds of a pomegranate. In other words, the message is that when you look deeper beneath the surface, you'll find good in everybody. Right? So what we're saying here is that we take the pomegranate, which symbolizes this idea, this teaching, that even people who look like they have no good deeds really are full of good deeds like the pomegranate, right? And then if we do that, if we take that message and we focus, because when we ask God to, you know, we all know that we mess up sometimes. So when we say that our marriage should increase, what it could also mean is that we ask God, you know, look away from our bad parts and focus on our good deeds. Do we have a right to ask God that of God? It depends. If we take the message of the pomegranate, and we find the good in everybody, even when you have to look deeper, then we have a right to ask of God to do the same thing to us, right? We often make assumptions about people externally when we meet them based on external things, and the pomegranate reminds us that we have to look deep, and we look deep, we'll find good in every person. And if we do that, then we have a right to ask of God to focus on our good deeds. So that's the message. Now we go on to fish. Fish is a Jewish thing, right? We say that may be God's will that we be fruitful and multiply like fish, right? Multiply, we need Jewish kids in this world, right? I always say that Jewish people cannot survive on 1.2 kids and a dog. We need kids, we need Jewish kids. But I don't know if anyone recognized these words. So we say we should be fruitful and multiply like fish. Again, there's a place in the Torah where somebody used the metaphor of fish. We should multiply like fish. Anyone know who that was? Jacob was blessing his grandchildren, Joseph's children. And he said, you should multiply like fish. Right? I was once studying this with a fellow, and he was actually in Northwestern University at the time. And I asked him why do you think that this metaphor of being like fish was used? What's it about fish that we should emulate? I had this very profound, deep concept to share with him. And when I asked him why do you think the Jewish people would be like fish, his answer was that Jewish people are always in school. That was pretty creative, and it's actually true. But what I wanted to share with him was another idea, and that is that fish represent living deeply. You know, you have basically on the ground, on the earth, you have all human beings and animals on one plane. Then you have fish that live on a deeper plane. They live in the water, in the depths of the water. They represent living deeply, right? And the mission of a Jew is to live, to be part of this world, but to do it deeply. You could have two people do the exact same thing, but it's not the exact same thing. Right now, picture you have two people, two dentists, right? They have offices right next to each other, colleagues. Each one is a dentist. And you ask one dentist, what do you do? How do you spend your day? So one dentist might say, well, I drill holes in people's teeth and I fill it with lead. That doesn't sound very profound or deep, right? The next dentist, the next room, when you ask him, what does he do? He might say, people come to me in pain and I alleviate their pain by drilling out the decay and replacing it with lead. And people come to me and they don't feel good about their smile and I help improve their smile. And when I do these two things, my tradition teaches me that I'm emulating God because I'm doing acts of kindness. So they're both doing the exact same thing. One is living deeply, one is not. So the message of being like fish is that we should live deeply, be part of this world, but in the way, in our goals and aspirations for life, the way we deal with other people, it should be deeply, we should be living deeply. There's another thing about fish. Have you ever noticed if you look a fish in the eye, eyes don't have something that we have on their eye. Fish, rather, don't have something on their eyes that we have. What don't they have? Eyelids. The eyes of a fish are always open. Right? And again, this is something we can say to ourselves and to our children and to our grandchildren. The mission of a Jew is to go through life, go through the world, relate to the world with our eyes always open. Right? 2,000 years ago, when the Jews lived under the Romans and the Romans went to the Colosseum for entertainment, the Jews' eyes were open. They said, this is not civilization, it's barbarism. That's the responsibility of a Jew, to always have their eyes open. Finally, one last one, head of a sheep or head of a fish. This is something that for people, I think, under 70 is kind of challenging. You know, the idea of having a sheep head or a fish, even a fish head on your table is kind of gets a little squirmy. In my family, what we started doing is we get a little white fish. Now that does not when it gets as squirmy when they're just a little head of a white fish. And we say we should be a leader. We should be like the head, not like the tail. The head, not like a tail. And one of the ways of understanding this is that we should be leaders, not followers. There's so much in today's world where we can just follow whatever most people say, whatever is in vogue, right? Again, the mission of a Jew is to meet, not to be a follower, but to be a leader. You know, I want to end with a story. I once read a story about this woman who turned 100 years old. So the family had a big party for her 100th birthday, and reporters came down to interview her. And they said to this woman, so how does it feel to be 100 years old? She said, well, one thing is that there is very little peer pressure. When 100 years old, very little peer pressure. The Jewish people are 3,000 years old. There's no peer pressure. We've been around for 3,000 years. We have our values, our morals, our perspectives on life, on the world. We have the message of the apple and the honey. That this whole wood is God's symphony, and that we shouldn't be impressed with peer pressure. If society moves away from these ideas, we have to preserve them and transmit them to our children. And so basically, hopefully these ideas can be incorporated into our meals and give meaning to our meals, and especially to the young people. Everyone here is young, but especially to the literally young people here, they should realize that they are not accidents. They are here. They're part of the symphony of God's world, and God needs them to make this world the kind of world that he wants it to be. And so I hope that these thoughts and these ideas will help elevate your holiday meal And the main thing is that we should make these requests with a full heart, and God willing, God should grant these requests that we should all have, as we say, a Shana Tova, a good year full of blessing and joy and happiness, and have a wonderful, wonderful year. And remember, sitting at a table on Rosh Hashanah, we should feel like $1 million, that we're part of the Jewish people, that we have this heritage that we're preserving and transmitting to the next generation. We should do so proudly, and we hopefully have a very meaningful Rosh Hashanah.